Hey, yo, Krishna, man. We're thinking of hitting up the bookstore. You want to come with us, though?
What?
We're going to get our textbooks. You want to come?
No, thanks.
Hey, come on, Krishna!
Look, my name is Chris. K-R-I-S. Is that so difficult to remember? Just leave me alone, okay? I don't feel like getting my books right now.
We can't conceive of brownness outside of race. But brownness is not reducible to race. Just as we can't conceive of brownness outside of ethnic, national, even religious categories. And yet, brownness is never reducible to any of those things.
Hey, Salim. Did you ever see that episode of Gilligan's Island where the personalities got switched?
I know what you mean. Somewhere in Jersey, there's a black guy driving around in a Honda Accord and praying to Lord Ganesh. Hey, hand me the sellotape, yeah.
Brownness always points to race, religion, and ethnicity. But it does so from a position outside of any of those categories. So it's not even the Venn diagram intersection of race, nationality, ethnicity. It's adjacent. It's a place that's constantly articulating itself in relation to those axes, but can never sort of be fit onto that grid.
Thank you for flying with us this holiday season. Before your trip begins, I'll be giving a brief safety demonstration for brown people. Most people can get to the airport an hour before their flight. But for us brown people, allow 8 to 10 hours. And if you have the word bin in your last name, just rent a car.
My name is Manu Samrithi Chander. I am Associate Professor of English at Rutgers University in Newark. And I'm the author, most recently, of Brown Romantics, Poetry and Nationalism in the Global 19th Century, which looks at the ways that colonial writers took up the tropes and philosophies and politics of canonical romantic writers and mobilized them toward nationalistic ends. I've also published an edition of the works of one of those Brown Romantics, Egbert Martin, and I'm currently at work on a collected volume of Martin's poetry and prose.
I would say welcome aboard, but this is a fake plane. Come on, I've played so many terrorists in movies, I can't go anywhere near a f***ing airport. Happy holidays, safe travels.
Over the course of writing the book, it became very clear to me that I felt a kind of kinship with these brown romantics, that thinking about their position within a world republic of letters that was relatively inhospitable toward them, I had numerous opportunities to reflect on my own position from childhood all the way up through my current role as a professor, as an educator, as an intellectual. To think about the ways in which my brownness bore an eerie relation to theirs, or maybe not so eerie, right? Maybe I started from my own experiences and projected them onto these writers that I was looking at. One way or the other, I ended up with a book where I felt like they weren't like my brothers exactly, but they're like distant cousins. In fact, I have a whole theory about how brownness is really about, instead of having sort of deep roots to the past, we have these relationships to other brown people that are kind of metonymic. We're sort of, instead of being represented by, you know, progenitors and elder statesmen, we're represented by, you know, our cousin. I don't know that that's relevant to anything here. Actually, I suppose it is kind of relevant when I think about it, because it's by that kind of strange kinship, that metonymy, for lack of a better word, that substitutability with your cousins, biological or in more cases than not, non-biological, that the basis of a kind of brown solidarity becomes possible. And that's really a solidarity that's not limited to, you know, to South Asians, to Middle Easterners, but that that encompasses or can encompass a wide range of peoples. It's that they have a peculiar relationship to cultural identity.
So I can be a romanticist, and I can show up at the Keats Shelley Association's annual symposium, and I can present on Keats or Wordsworth. But the ways in which I am able to participate in that dialogue are restricted prior to my participation. Brownness is that position which can be inhabited by people of different national, ethnic, religious backgrounds. It's that position where you can have a seat at the table, but you can only have a specific seat at the table. And God forbid that seat should be the head. I mean, at the moment when brown folks are sitting at the head of the table, that's when you know the dinner's over.
Thank you, come again.
Okay, the first time I think I encountered the idea of brownness, the ideas of always there, but the word was in Vijay Prashad's Karma of Brown Folk, which I feel like if you're, you know, a liberal arts studying Indian American, you've read. Not just us, but I think every they see of my generation that I know, you know, who was studying arts and history, the humanities in one way or another, saw that book and had some kind of transformative experiences.
White supremacy treats black folk as if they are themselves a problem, a history that lingers on as more and more is said about personal responsibility, and as the US government divests itself and the economic system of any culpability in the genocide against blacks. As South Asians have entered the United States in the past 30 years, there has been a tendency to compare our destiny with that of black folk. If these brown folk can make it, say people like Thomas Sowell, Dinesh D'Souza, and the neoconservatives, then why can't black folk?
In a way, I mean, you know, the book is really about Afro-Asian solidarity. It's taking on the sort of model minority project of mobilizing brown people, Indians against African-Americans, and other oppressed minorities.
But there is also another question that needs to be asked. How does it feel to be a solution? Addressed to all Asians, but increasingly with reference to South Asians, this question asks us brown folk how we can live with ourselves as we are pledged and sometimes, in an act of bad faith, pledge ourselves as a weapon against black folk.
But it's also a history of Indian, people of Indian descent in America, and was the first time I thought that of something like a kind of brown solidarity. It's the first time I think I encountered the word brown and understood that there was a term that applied to me. One thing that just occurred to me was there's this this movie Scratch, which is about DJs. And there's one DJ Babu, who's with the Dilated Peoples, who has this great quote where he says, growing up Filipino, you know, you didn't have any role models. You just had DJ Qbert.
For Filipinos, or American Filipinos at least, we don't really have role models, you know, as far as mass media goes. You know, there's no athletes, there's no actors. You know, we have our parents, and Qbert. And, you know, whether Q likes or dislikes the idea, he's very much a role model. You see it. You know, even the Australian DJ champs are a couple Filipino guys. You know what I mean? It's more than a coincidence, you know. And I really attribute it to Qbert and Mike and Apollo, like, putting the DJing out there so much.
I thought it was, like, hilarious. And I kind of think that time of my life was in terms of, like, Vijay Prashad, you know, growing up Indian American, like, you had your parents, like, you know, they were cool, you had your older sisters, but, like, when you found Vijay Prashad and you found someone who was, like, laying down left politics and notions of, like, cultural solidarity, man, that's when you came into your own.
Look at all these Indian faces, Jesus Christ. Look at you, brown bastards, god damn. Indians just look upset that they had to spend money to be here tonight, don't you? There's a look on their face. Just... This is bullshit. I don't know why I'm spending money to see someone that looks just like me.
Yeah, my understanding of brownness is obviously shaped by what we might call a hyphenated identity and what it means to be Indian American, which is certainly tied to this idea of, you know, being sort of both included within and excluded from various cultural categories, existing at the sort of adjacent to normatively defined categories of nation, state, ethnicity, race, religion, etc. I don't think that that is particular to people who identify as hyphenated subjects. I think what it means to have a cultural identity is to always be conceiving of yourself and conceived of in relation to other cultural identities. In a way, the position of brownness is really one in which the hyphen is visible instead of repressed. The hyphen calls forth or makes visible the fact that we can't exist in relation to a single culture, that there's no such thing as subjectivity or certainly cultural identity in which the culture in question is singular. Culture is only a meaningful category insofar as we conceive of cultures in the plural. And the hyphen, I think, is a mark of that inevitability. So I think what I'm trying to say is that there's no such thing as cultural identity without the hyphen. We don't have cultural existence merely in relationship to a single culture. Culture is only a meaningful category insofar as it refers to plurality. But the position of brownness is one from which you don't have the luxury of repressing the hyphen.
Incredible. And how does your South Asian background influence your character development and with the interpersonal dynamics with the other staff, with the other cast members play out?
A part of me. It's who I am. It's who I am. I don't know. So. Sorry, I don't know.
I like that people do think you're Asian sometimes, right?
They do. They're like, are you half Korean? I'm like, no. Jewish guy from Chicago.
Well, you know, I get a lot of tweets and input from young Indian women or Indian American women who feel inspired by what I've done, and it's so, I love it, and it's daunting and it's frightening. Because there's not any Indian female comedy leads in anything. And that's when I get really jealous of the Danny McBrides and the Steve Carells. Because when they play a character, you're not like, what are you saying about white men with this portrayal of Michael Scott? They just get to play Michael Scott. And so when I play this character and I want to play like a fun character who makes like big flaws and things like that, I sometimes think that I'm speaking for all Indian American women. And so I'm kind of like, damn it, why wasn't this 75 years in the future? When you're like, enough Indian American women. We're sick of it.
Too many.
Too many.
Oh, another show about a female American Indian woman.
And then I could kind of just do whatever. But in terms of how it inspires it, you know, I have this thing where, you know, once you heard someone say this about their ethnicity in some form, great footnote. But I just heard that it was just that, that it was like that I try not to like rely on it or deny the fact that I'm Indian. I mean, you turn on the show and you'll know that I'm Indian. I can't hide that. And we've tried.
We have. We did some makeup tests. It looked weird.
Makeup tests looked weird. We have a very offensive pilot where I pretend we're black. That should never come out.
No, that'll be hidden. That's buried.
That's bad.
You'll never see it.
But you know, in the office, I wrote this episode called Diwali, and wow, that's nice.
Good episode.
And so it comes up, but I decided to, you know, I don't speak any Indian languages. And I'm Hindu, but I don't know that much about my religion. But that's kind of interesting, and I feel like other people might be doing sort of the same thing. So it...
What's that?
But anyway, so it comes up in the show sometimes, but, you know, as much as it organically would. King of the swingers, oh, the jungle VIP.
I've reached the top and had to stop. You're invariably tied to your position amidst and among multiple positions. It's impossible from the position of brownness to sustain the illusion of cultural purity.
And I think I've said this before, but it bears repeating. Brownness is a position. As I conceive of it, it can't be conceived of as a kind of an a priori category. Obviously, there's nothing essential about brown. It's a position within a field of possible positions. It's one that moves and which is variable because that field of positions is dynamic, and yet it's never a position of privilege, nor is it a position of abject otherness. It's a position of limited access. It's a restricted position. One of the things that I need to be very clear about is that my conception of brownness and what I've done with it, there's no articulating it without coming back to the constraints of the English language. It's in some ways, it's an idea of cultural identity and cultural positionality that's reliant upon my primary language, English. But you asked also about Apu from The Simpsons, or Apu, or Apu.
Asa Pima Petalon is exactly what it is spelled. Can I tell you something which is annoying? Don't understand.
And I mean, I think what Hari Kondabolu did was he just reminded us that there are different sets of standards for what we consider prejudice. Bigotry and racism.
When I first moved to LA, most of the 7-Eleven guys were Indian or Pakistani, and there was one in particular who lived near me who was pretty crusty. And I would often, I had the same exchange with him all the time. I would be online buying a drink, and I'd open the Gatorade before I'm waiting to pay, and he would get annoyed. Why do you open? You haven't paid for it yet. Don't open until you have paid.
That it had sort of long been ingrained within the culture, within popular culture, and within specifically the kind of the liberal mindset of the Harvard writers, of Harvard-educated writers of The Simpsons, that you couldn't represent African Americans in that kind of racist, cartoonish way. I think what Hardy did was point out that liberal sensibility discovers its limits when you get to a character like Apu. When you get to a character who's okay to caricature.
So he kind of, I think a lot of impressions for me, like for example, I can tell when I'm getting annoyed with someone in life still when I start impersonating them. It means it's how I work out aggression. It's sort of like, it's my way of like, saying, I'm observing how annoying you are. This is what you sound like.
You know, and I follow Hardy on Twitter, and so I've seen like the really horrible responses he's gotten from people. Go fuck a cow. Go fucking die. I mean, people are pissed off.
It means it's how I work out aggression. It's sort of like, it's my way of like, I'm observing how annoying you are. This is what you sound like. This is what you sound like. This is what you sound like. This is what you sound like.
And where does that anger come from? Does it come from like a deep love of The Simpsons? Does it come from a frustration with left political sensibilities? Does it come from not just the right and people who are overtly racist, but also from people who have sort of grown up embracing a set of liberal norms. In a way, I think what I'm trying to say is the backlash against Hardy may not simply be symptomatic of the rise of conservatism, sort of alt-right racism, but an actual crisis within liberalism that's always been there. A crisis that, in fact, is constitutive of liberalism.
Let's talk about this documentary, which has thrust you into a firestorm, it feels like.
Yeah. I can't check my Twitter mentions.
Right, because yeah. You have made this documentary, which is really interesting and hilarious, about Apu from The Simpsons. Some people say you've made this movie to say that Apu is only racist and it is bad and you are angry. Are you angry?
I'm 35 years old. This cartoon's been around for a while. I got other things to worry about. I mean, to be honest, you want to really know what I think of Apu?
Yeah.
The network's not going to like this, but I don't really give a
Wait, if you don't give a shit, why did you make the story about Apu?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, because I feel like there's a gap, you know what I mean? There's a bunch of stuff that happened that wasn't covered because, like, brown people weren't allowed to talk until, like, 15 years ago. You know,
right.
We're talking about the pre-Aziz and Mindy era.
Right.
Right?
I like that, pre-Aziz and Mindy era.
Yeah, PAM. And, but yeah, so we weren't allowed to talk. So there's this huge gap in who we were and what that experience is like and what it feels like when your only image is a cartoon character voiced by a white guy. So it's a white guy in brown paint, and this country has a history of that. So.
Well, when you look at the story of The Simpsons, though, there are people who say, but Hari, you can't say this about The Simpsons, though. The Simpsons offends everybody equally. Some people would argue that Homer Simpson's is a stereotype of a white man who's not well-educated in America, and the family and the townspeople represent stereotypes or caricatures of everyone. So why would you be offended by Apu?
Because there's a lot of different white characters, and we just had a convenience store guy voiced by a white guy with brown paint.
It really is just representation.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I wanted to call the film, I gotta explain this to you. it's representation. I mean, we had this one thing, and that matters, and I think a lot about post 9/11, stick with me. You know, we only had two representations, brown people in this country, whether
right.
that's South Asian, Arab, Muslim. Right? We had Apu from The Simpsons, harmless convenience store character, and we had terrorists, right? And there's a huge range of humanity between those points.
Right.
And so, but that didn't exist on television media at the time, so all of a sudden there's all these hate crimes and deportations and detentions, because if you only have two places, convenience store owner, terrorist, where are you gonna go, right? Meanwhile, white guys, like a middle-aged white dude can shoot up Las Vegas and no one's going after all middle-aged white guys, right? That would be an absurd thing. No one's like, oh, it's a middle-aged white guy, get him, don't shoot, it's Steve Carell. Like, that's never, that's not gonna happen.
That's an interesting idea in that the lack of representation fundamentally shapes how people see the
Absolutely.
World around them. So when looking at this character, Apu, there are people who say, and I've seen, funny enough, on your Twitter, I've seen online, people who are South Asian yeah. saying, no, man, why are you doing this? I enjoy Apu. He's my dude. I laugh at this. Well, why is it such a bad thing?
I enjoy Apu. I think Apu's a really funny character, but just because something's funny doesn't make it right. In fact, if something is wrong, the fact it's funny makes it easier to push it forward. That's how any kind of propaganda works. That's how anything that is good art that has a messed up message works, right? So for me, it's like, if we had a bunch of other characters at that time, then Apu would have been fine. It was just one of many characters, but that's all we had. And when you can shape, I don't know if you know this, but there's like, a billion of us.
Wait, like here?
No, my God.
Oh,
if there was a billion of us here, I'd have a show right now.
I went to grad school to study post-colonial poetry, which was at the time a burgeoning field. The post-colonial studies had really been largely devoted to studies of the novel. At that time in the early 2000s, a couple of things happened. One, probably the most important, was I went to a post-colonialism conference. It's the annual conference on South Asia in Madison. It's not really a post-colonial conference, but I was giving a paper on Dalit poetry by the historically oppressed, the quote-unquote outcasts of India. But I was offering an analysis that was deeply rooted in questions of form and style, and there didn't seem to be much of a place for it there. There was also a fairly close-knit community of people who go to the Madison Conference every year, brown folks, I wasn't really on the in crowd with them. Sort of always had my own sort of ambivalent relationship to brownness. I think like many second gen Americans. Proud wore it as a badge of honor, but also, from a young age had sort of distanced myself from brown communities. So I think that was one moment where, I started to think about ways in which other fields might fit better, both intellectually and culturally, I suppose. I guess the other key moment was when I read Spivak's Critique of Postcolonial Reason, and specifically the chapter on Kant, section of chapter one on Kant, which just blew me away. And I started reading more deeply into Kant, and I still think that he's probably my sort of window into Romanticism. It didn't come from the poets. It didn't come from any of the big six. It came from, Kant, and then specifically, his role in the history of aesthetic theory. His problems of taste and alterity that really got me interested in thinking about that moment in history. And then the path forward from there was to work on, poets sort of writing at the end of the 19th century, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. So I found myself in sort of in Romanticism, not quite by accident, but I wasn't a Wordsworth file or a Keats file, or I had no sort of strong allegiance to any of the Romantic poets. There were certain other things that the more I studied Romanticism became deeply exciting to me. So that at the time that I was in grad school, new work on Romantic Orientalism by Sadi Makhdisi and Nigel Leask and others was being put out, and I could start to see the ways in which a study of Romanticism and the questions of empire that had sort of driven me earlier on could actually intersect in interesting ways. By the time I finished grad school, several more studies in that sort of field of Romantic Orientalism had come out. And beginning my first couple of years at Rutgers Newark as an assistant professor, I began to question whether I had anything more to really add to that discussion, and whether there wasn't something that I found troubling, not just about the discussions, but I think sort of more personally for me. I mean, the questions of Romantic Orientalism nearly always centers around, if not just those big six romantics, Blake, Coleridge, Wordsworth, Byron, Keats, and Shelley, a relatively small group of English poets, to some extent novelists. That had never been my sort of area of interest. I was always interested in brown writers, colonial writers. And so that's really what led me to the project that became my first book. I scrapped my dissertation. I published a few articles out of it, but started a book from scratch with the idea of thinking through the ways in which Romanticism was shaping nationalist and proto-nationalist aesthetics in colonial spaces like India, Australia, Guyana. Guyana is where the focus of my work, current work, is as well. In a way, I think what's been the sort of problem I've been working through has been to think about the ways that romantic, even when we think about the romantics' deployment of Orientalist tropes, dependence on logics of imperialism, the fact of the centering of the romantics is already a problem of empire. And so I've become interested in what happens, whether it's possible to hang on to the idea of romantic without sort of situating it neatly or primarily in England, in Western Europe.
The first tape I ever bought was Run-DMC's Raising Hell. And the last track on there, I don't know if you know it, but it's Proud to Be Black. And so I would go around rapping along to Proud to Be Black. You know I'm proud to be black, y'all, and that's a fact, y'all. And if you try to take what's mine and take it back, y'all, it's like that. And so I think, I can't remember how old I was, maybe like third grade or something like that, but nobody really knew anything about race on any sort of intellectual level. I mean, I went to this Catholic school, and it was, you know, almost all white. And I remember my friend saying, "Wait, are you black?" And me being like, "I think so."
Sure, Carlton. What's it gonna be? Cat in the Hat or Curious George?
No, it's the Wall Street Journal. The part where AMC goes belly up.
Are you sure we're all related?
Mom, Dad, I've been thinking it over, and I've decided what I want to be when I grow up.
What, tall? That's nice, honey. What?
President of the United States.
Well, that would make me very proud, Carlton. Imagine, my son, the country's first black president.
I'm black?
And one other story from back then, which was I was Hindu, so I didn't like do all the I didn't do all the stuff that they did at Catholic school. Like they practiced taking communion, they said the Our Father, they did all that kind of stuff. And one time this girl said, so wait, you don't believe in God? And not having any sense that Hindus believe in God, not being able to discern what it meant, to believe in God and to believe in a non-Christian God, my response was, nope.
Isn't it true that you're really an Indian?
By many arms of Vishnu, I swear it is a lie.
And I think like that space between sort of positively determined positions, in this case, religious subjectivities, is one that I've come to hold dear as a signal, a mark of brownness.